The following program is a presentation of the Flypod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
Flypod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Today we have the number one New York Times best-selling author of her brand new book, Circe, Madeline Miller. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
All right. Now, I know from reading a little bit that when you were little, your mother used to read stories. Not like Dr. Seuss or anything, but she used to read you stories about ancient gods.
It's true. She also read me, for the record, Dr. Seuss and Goodnight Moon and The Runaway Bunny. But yes, I think she just knew me really well, and she had really loved the myths as well herself. And so she started reading me passages from the Iliad and the Odyssey, and I just fell completely in love. I have a memory of her reading the first line of the Iliad to me, which is, "Sing, goddess of the destructive rage of Achilles." And I was completely hooked. It was, you know, we're not in Goodnight Moon anymore.
And you weren't like a teenager when she was doing this. You were little.
I was, yeah. I was sort of five and up. So it's very funny. And now I have my own young children. I have a four-year-old. And so, of course, I am starting to introduce her to the myths because I love them so much. And children, I think, always love them. But I was just telling her Daedalus and Icarus the other day, and we were looking at a picture of, you know, Icarus tumbling into the ocean. She said, "Mommy, what happens to that little boy?" And I was like, "Oh, his daddy saves him. That's what happens." And she's like, "Oh, good." So I don't know if I quite have the guts to give her the full version yet.
But, you know, with the gods reading of the mythology, Greek and Roman, kids today, are they really interested in that?
I have found, so I'm also, before these novels came out, I was a high school teacher for many years, and I absolutely found that kids respond to these so strongly. I think they're exciting stories, they're adventure stories, but they're also very revealing about human nature. I think they don't pull any punches about, you know, grieving and loss and death and love and yearning and passion. All those really exciting things are in there, and I think it allows, you know, children's imaginations to really blossom and to live out the sort of struggles that they're having in their own life on this huge, exciting canvas. So I have never had a student who, after, you know, getting a good dose of mythology, still thought it was boring.
Well, you are out of Circe. This is Greek mythology?
Yes.
Because the Roman gods and the Greek gods may be the same, but they have different names.
Yes, they do. And some slightly different aspects in some cases. Circe is pretty much the same in both Greek literature and Roman literature. And Roman writers did write about her. She appears in Virgil's Aeneid and in Ovid's Metamorphoses. So she's been written about in both, but you still call her Circe. Although, if I want to be really, really technical, the Greek would be Kyrke, but I didn't go with that.
That's good, because I don't know if I could pronounce it. Now, introduce me to Circe.
So she is the daughter of the sun god Helios, which makes her a Titan as opposed to an Olympian. The Olympian gods are Zeus and all of his brothers and sisters and children, and Zeus sort of takes over from the Titans. Of course, they're all related to each other. They're all cousins because Zeus's father was a Titan. But there's a little bit of a kind of, you know, sharks and jets kind of Titans and Olympians thing going on.
Ooh, that's pretty good.
And so she is the first witch in Western literature, which was very interesting to me. And she's most famous for her appearance in the Odyssey, where Odysseus lands with his men on her island of Aeaea as he's trying to get back home from the Trojan War to his family in Ithaca. He lands on her island, and she turns some of his men into pigs. And then she and he become lovers, and she turns them back. And he ends up staying on her island for a year. So she has these magical spell powers that are different from her divinity. And that was something that really interested me about her too, is that she was born a goddess, but she makes herself a witch. And the goddess, she, you know, when we talk about someone being born a goddess, that sounds pretty good, but she was born as a nymph, which means that she is the lowest of the low. The Greek gods were very hierarchical. And so if you were Zeus or Hera or Athena, one of the big names, you were at the top and you could pretty much do whatever you wanted. But the nymphs in mythology are the very, very bottom. They're basically almost human. And they have very little power and no control over their destiny. They're used as pawns. They're treated as prey. And so part of what I was interested in with Circe is she is born into this role with very little control over her own destiny, but she finds a way to carve out that power, and witchcraft is sort of how she does it.
And, you know, as she's born almost human, her brothers and sisters pretty much make fun of her. She's not the most beautiful god in goddom, I guess, but for a mortal looking at her, she's a beautiful woman, right?
Yes, absolutely. So by mortal standards, she's a knockout. But among the gods, she's not that impressive. And actually, I was drawing a little bit on a detail that Homer gives us about her for that kind of understanding of who she is and how she fits in. Because Homer describes her as the dread goddess who speaks like a mortal, like a human. And that was a fascinating tidbit for me, because it implies that there is a piece of her that does belong to the mortal world and that is not fully at home in the divine world. She's a creature of two worlds, kind of straddling, not belonging fully to either. And so I thought, you know, someone who had that, who spoke like a mortal instead of like a god, would be a little bit of an outcast among the gods. And so that was a key, that description from the Odyssey was a key part of me creating her character.
Circe's dad, he seemed to love his daughter. Did he have maybe more pity on her than love?
I think Helios, I think that the Greek gods don't have a lot of love for anyone other than themselves. The most of the Greek gods, if you look in the mythology, are actually really horrendous. They're self-absorbed. We would call them, you know, sociopathic narcissists today. They do whatever they want. They'll step on whoever they want. And all they really care about is their own desires. So I think, you know, Helios is no different. He's the sun god, so he's particularly powerful, and it's often the particularly powerful gods who are the most, you know, self-absorbed. And he, I think, sees her, you know, almost as an extension of himself. She is useful to him as long as she is obedient and pleasing, and, you know, maybe he can marry her off and make a good alliance with her. But I think he doesn't really have any interest in her for herself, only as sort of how she fits into his plans.
The sun god, we visit pretty much a ranch where he has nothing but white cattle. I thought that you drew the description of that very well. How were you able to do that? Was it just everybody knows what a cow is and they're white and that sets the picture? Or how did you do that?
So that detail also comes from the Odyssey, that he has this herd of pure white cattle. And actually, they play an important role in the Odyssey, because Circe tells Odysseus, if you pass by my father's island, don't eat the cattle, because he's going to, you know, be extremely angry. And Odysseus they do, in fact, have to land on the island. And Odysseus tries to keep watch over them, but he falls asleep. And while he's asleep, his men go and slaughter the cattle and eat them. And in return, Helios has Zeus throw a thunderbolt at their ship, and everyone is killed except for Odysseus. So I really wanted them in there, because they're very significant later. But it also seems like such a weird sort of god thing to have this island with this pure white cattle. So I think in terms of thinking of it, I looked in a little bit to ancient depictions of cows. And one thing that's interesting is that the ancients really thought the cows were beautiful, in particular their eyes. And oftentimes you'll see some of the most beautiful goddesses described as being cow-eyed, meaning presumably that they have these beautiful large eyes with beautiful lashes. And so I wanted to capture some of that beauty, and the fact that they really admire these creatures. I wanted it to be a little unearthly. There really are two of Circe's half-sisters, two other nymphs, daughters of Helios, whose job it is to just be on the island taking care of these cows. brows and keeping them looking fabulous all the time. I mean, it just kind of wrote itself. As a writer, those sorts of scenes are really fun because you get to immerse yourself in this startling, beautiful, alien world.
With Circe, what would you classify this book as, a historical fiction? How would you classify it?
I usually don't call it myself historical fiction. Both Circe and The Song of Achilles, my first novel, get called historical fiction. But they do, you know, that's always a little strange to me because they have centaurs and six-headed monsters and angry divinities in them.
Well, I've seen some of those.
Yeah. So I have made up my own genre, and I think of them as mythological realism. Kind of like magical realism, but about myth. So I want to take the stories very seriously, but I want to also honor the fantasy elements. And really, the other sort of genre that I consider my books is literary adaptation, because what I'm really doing is I'm taking Homer's world as my world. So Homer's world has gods and monsters, so therefore mine does as well. And I'm really writing within his world. And it's a privilege to get to write in Homer's world, because he's such a vivid, beautiful, expansive poet that there's room. There's room for other people to kind of set up camp in a little corner. But I do historical research on it because, you know, there are some, particularly on the material culture. So when I'm describing clothes or I'm describing archaeological, at one point Circe goes to Crete where her sister is queen. Circe is, among other things, I didn't mention this when I was describing her, but she is the aunt of the Minotaur, which is a pretty exciting thing. So she ends up on Crete where the Minotaur is born and the labyrinth and Daedalus and that whole myth. And so I looked at some material culture for Crete from sort of roughly the time period, Minoan culture, and I did a bunch of research into ancient looms. And most of that stuff stays pretty much under the surface. It's just for me to better imagine it. And I drop in a little detail here, a little detail there. But there is a historical basis for it. But it isn't set in any one particular historical time because, of course, it's mythological.
So do you know the story that well where you wouldn't have to have maybe a map in your writing room, if you will? You wouldn't have to have maybe who begot who?
Because I have been obsessed with these stories for so long, I actually do not have to have that. It's mostly in my head. When you get into some of the really obscure deities, you know, and sometimes myths contradict each other. I mean, that's one of the things that's exciting about myth, is that there is no such thing as a definitive myth. You know, you can talk about Homer's version and Virgil's version and, you know, Margaret Atwood's version and James Joyce's version and, you know, all the versions over the years. So sometimes I look up alternate versions. You know, I know kind of the top two main versions, and I might look up, you know, oh, is this person always this person's daughter? Or sometimes in Circe's story, for instance, in some versions she has three siblings, and in some versions only two. So, which sounds like a very minor detail, but actually was something that gave me fits as I was working on the beginning of the novel, because it really changes family dynamic. Do you have four kids or do you have three kids? You know, do you have the triangle or do you have the square? So, yes, the short answer is yes. I do know it pretty well, but I, you know, occasionally we'll do some research.
Well, I like the long answer better. Anyway, you know, I've seen this book cover before I got it, and I don't know if it was in the New York Times, but it's been out there. I would guess a number one seller in its own right.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, I was shocked. It was really exciting, and I felt a little bit delirious.
So book number two, both books, I guess, number one bestsellers.
Oh, just Circe.
Just Circe?
Yep. Song of Achilles was a New York Times bestseller, but not number one.
Wow. So what's it like for you to be a number one New York Times bestseller?
It feels a little surreal. It feels a little surreal to me. When I got the news, I was actually in D.C. for a wonderful event at the bookstore Politics and Prose, and I had a little time before, so I was at the zoo and I was looking at the pandas. I had gone to visit the pandas, and I got this call from my publicist, and when I picked up the line, there were about eight people on the line. It was my editor and my publicist and my editor's boss and my agent, and I thought, oh, uh-oh. My first thought, of course, is, uh-oh, something bad has happened, and they're like, we have something to tell you, and I, you know, just, I remember, I think I shrieked, I'm sure I frightened the pandas, right there in the middle of the Washington Zoo. So it was so exciting and very surreal, but it hasn't, I mean, what's interesting is that it has, I think, brought more attention to the novel, and, you know, as my publisher said, for the rest of my life, you know, I get to have that in my resume. So, but the, you know, there's so much about books and book selling and book launch that is just luck. So I feel very fortunate. I feel very lucky.
You know, if I were one of the pandas or I was around you at the zoo, I would have guessed that the phone call might have been something like, Madeline, where are you at? We're having this great party with some fantastic champagne. And you missed the party. Maybe not. All right. So, you know, the myths. Would you say from your point of view that might be the first books of fantasy?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think if Homer were composing today, you know, he would probably be shelved in fantasy. And, you know, ditto Beowulf. so many of kind of our Western classics deal with have fantastical elements in them. And I think that we have sort of created these artificial genres of, you know, and sometimes, and oftentimes we rank them too, you know, that some genres are considered better than other genres. But I believe in crossing genre boundaries as much as possible. So, and approaching, you know, different stories from a literary perspective or from a more fantastical perspective. There was a wonderful book that I found fascinating, which was written by Colson Whitehead. He's most recently famous for The Underground Railroad, which was an Oprah book pick, and a lot of people read this incredibly important and wonderful book. But before that, he wrote a book called Zone One, which was a zombie novel. And he is pretty much, I think, one of the most literary, you know, he is maybe considered one of the top literary novelists of our time. And here he is writing about zombies. But it was wonderful to put those things together and to sort of, and, you know, there have been so many authors over the years that have already crossed those boundaries. Ursula K. Le Guin was so frustrated that she used to get stuck in fantasy because she felt like, you know, these are eternal stories and these are stories that really belong to everyone. And that's really how I feel about Homer, is that these stories belong to everyone. They belong to all of humanity. That's how they were in the ancient world. I think a little bit we've gotten this, now it's kind of, sometimes people think that Homer is just for certain people or you have to have a certain kind of education to approach Homer. But the truth is that these were originally stories that were passed down from, you know, grandparent to parent to child. They were told around fires. They were, you know, they were kind of part of the everyday culture of everyday people, as well as, you know, things that were sung in palaces for kings. So I like trying to pitch my books in such a way that anyone could pick them up to try and honor that original thing that they were for everyone.
If you can believe the internet, which I probably do, in places of the burials for the ancients, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's the Aztecs, whether it's the Romans, mm-hmm. they all seem to have kind of the same characters on their walls. Mm. I mean, you know, here we have the mythological book here, and by Homer and others. Do you think that these are actually star people?
Hmm.
Could they have been real?
Could they have been real? I mean, I think that I'm more come down on the Joseph Campbell side, where I think that there are certain narratives that, as people, you know, we all experience. I mentioned love and loss and grief. And so I think it makes sense that a lot of our stories would kind of converge around similar ideas. And of course, you know, the ancient Mediterranean world, there was lots of traffic all around. You know, nowadays we think that maybe the Greeks made it all the way up to, you know, to the Vikings, and they, you know, Alexander the Great went into India. And so there was information flow, particularly along merchant and trade routes. And so whether or not little bits of those stories were filtering here and filtering there, I'm sure that they were. Because what is, you know, one of human beings' favorite things to do is pass on a good story. So to me, it makes sense that there would be that kind of overlap, both because I think as humans, there are certain stories that just resonate with us about, you know, the hero's journey and overcoming obstacles. And the Odyssey, when you take out the gods and monsters, is really just the story of an exhausted veteran who wants to get home to his family. And, you know, those types of stories, I think, can be told in any culture, in any time. So I kind of come at it more from that perspective.
You know, you're talking about the author that was writing about not only the Underground Railroad, but the living dead, pretty much. Do you find yourself staying in this genre that you're reading or writing? Or do you see yourself maybe going out more fantasy, maybe creating your own world? maybe doing something altogether different.
Yes, absolutely. I mentioned that I have loved these myths since I was a child, but I've also loved writing since I was a child. But for years and years, all through kind of up until college, those tracks were completely separate. I was writing contemporary fiction, and then I was, you know, obsessed and learning ancient Greek and Latin and starting to study the literature. And what happened to bring those two things together was this really strange accident where a friend asked me to co-direct a production of Troilus and Cressida, which is Shakespeare's version of the Iliad. And I loved it. And it was so exciting, you know, having studied all this stuff academically, to be working with it where I get to tell the stories myself. And I got to be part of shaping the actors' portrayals of Achilles and Agamemnon and Ajax. That was incredibly exciting. And so when that was over, it was, I didn't want to stop. And that was really the beginning of the Song of Achilles. So it was kind of an accident that I ended up in this genre. I could certainly see myself writing contemporary fiction at some point. I think I always have to go where the character is, you know, and what story and what character has really gripped me and won't let go. I actually think I might be done with Homer's world. You know, Patroclus and Achilles and Circe were the characters that I really wanted to explore. And so I think there isn't another character right now from Homer's world that is calling to me. The story that's calling to me is actually Shakespeare's Tempest. So after I directed that play, I ended up falling in love with Shakespeare and becoming a Shakespeare director and a theater director as well. So Shakespeare is the other great love of my life, other than classics. So that, I think, is a similar genre because it's also literary adaptation. It's kind of writing back to an established author. But I can also imagine moving out of literary adaptation entirely.
Right now, you are really not a full-time author, I guess. You teach, am I correct on that?
I tutor. I do a bunch of tutoring. I can't, I was a high school teacher, and high school teaching, it's really hard to do it even part-time, just because you get absorbed in the students and in the work there. It's I won't say there's no such thing as part-time high school teaching, but it's rare.
So how has high school changed since you were out? I can't imagine you being out all that long.
Well, that's very kind. It's been a while. How has it changed? Well, I think the huge sea change is obviously the internet. I think there was one kid in my class who knew what email was, you know, in my graduating class. Maybe there were two. But the rest of us had no idea. You know, we had never gone to a website. We'd never logged on. And it wasn't until kind of college that started happening. Whereas nowadays, my students, you know, they have their phones all the time and they're on Snapchat and Instagram and all those things. You know, I don't want to be, I think it's the classic trope of the older generation saying, like, in my day things were better. So I'm not gonna pass judgment. I'm just gonna say that luckily I'm very glad personally that I did not have all those things. I think it puts a lot of pressure on students to be kind of constantly performing and on. I loved as a kid going home and picking up a book and not seeing my classmates till the next morning, you know, or if someone called me, you know, being able to kind of, that was as connected as I got. I could make a phone call and talk to my friends. And that sort of private time and time for reflection and away from that kind of buzzy connection was incredibly important to me. So I hope that even within the whirlwind of social media, that students can still try and find those calm moments where it's just them and the page or just them in the woods. So I try and encourage that in my students as much as possible.
So Circe, a number one New York Times book, which is fantastic. What's next?
So I mentioned The Tempest. That story is kind of bubbling away. I'm very interested in the figure of Caliban, who I think is a fascinating, very complex character. He's the monster character. And I'm also love the Aeneid, Virgil's Aeneid. And Virgil, so I'm kind of looking at possibly a story set within the world of Virgil's Aeneid. And I find Virgil fascinating. He was the great poet of the Roman Empire, and he wrote the Aeneid specifically to be sort of the answer to the Iliad and the Odyssey. You know, this is the Roman version of the Iliad and the Odyssey. But what was interesting about him is that when he was born into a republic. Rome was a republic. And when he died under when it was an empire. And so he saw that transition from, you know, Senate rule to single man being in charge. And he lived through, you know, brutal civil wars and people being killed for, you know, trying to speak out against the emperor. I think a lot of that is reflected in his poetry. I think Virgil is a beautiful humanist. And, you know, by the time he was writing this, he really had the emperor breathing down his neck, you know, looking at everything he was writing and making sure, you know, is this on brand and on message for me? But I think Virgil was able to sneak in a lot of subversive stuff underneath that. And I find that fascinating as a reader. So I'd love to kind of explore some of those more subversive elements that he was able to kind of put out under the radar as the emperor is trying to control what he's writing.
All right, so if I want to find out more about Circe, about the Song of Achilles, or any other book you have coming out in the near future, I'm sure you have a website.
I do, www.madelinemiller.com.
And what are we going to see when we go to your website?
So you'll have...
It's not going to be just be an under construction on there.
No, right? I promise. I promise not. I actually have a... There was a lovely designer who made some beautiful art for it. So there's even some art. Q&As with me, frequently answered questions. They're actually reader's guides with questions for book groups, because I get a lot of questions from book groups and they say, you know, we'd love some kind of questions to think about. So I wrote up some of those. More information on the books and the characters. I have a whole character glossary on there. I have pictures from my trip to Troy and about seeing the ruins of Troy. So I tried to make it a really fun and an interesting website with lots of videos and interactive things.
All right, so check out the website. Check out the book, Circe. This lady is fascinating. One of my favorite scenes in the book is where she's sitting along the banks and a ship comes in and there's a fisherman on board and she introduces herself to the fisherman. And he's never met a goddess before, I don't think. And soon they fall in love. You're going to love the book, Circe. Madeline, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Cover to Cover. I've been your host, Mark Dewitt, along with Madeline Miller, author of her brand new book, Circe.
To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.